Here, let me Google that for you. The company's CEO goes to Capitol Hill. Congress, it turns out, could have used some tech support. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Ryssdal. It is Tuesday, today the 11th of December. Good as always to have you along, everybody. This was an interesting day, actually, in the politics of the American economy. There was that Oval Office meeting between President Trump, Nancy Pelosi, and Chuck Schumer, which turned nasty-ish over the prospect of a government shutdown. There was tariff news, which we'll get to in a minute. And there was Google's CEO Sundar Pichai making his first ever appearance before Congress, which is where we are going to start. There were questions about user privacy for Mr. Pichai. There were questions about bias in the company's search results. And not just a couple of questions along these lines. It's Democrat Zoe Lofgren of California doing the asking here.
Right now, if you Google the word idiot under images, a picture of Donald Trump comes up. I just did that. How would that happen? How does search work so that that would occur?
We played you that question, which is, yes, pointed, so we can get to some answers about life online in this economy and what Congress might have to do with that. Sophia Noble teaches at the Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism at USC. She writes extensively on algorithms in search and how they affect what we see. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So we had Representative Lofgren there talking to Sundar Pichai. The Google CEO answered for a little while, and then the conversation went on like this. And here's the second part of that exchange. Here you go.
And that's how we make sure the process is working.
So it's not some little man sitting behind the curtain figuring out what we're going to show the user. It's basically a compilation of what users are generating and trying to sort through that information.
Last year, we served over 3 trillion searches. And just as a fact, every single day, 15% of the searches Google sees, we have never seen them before.
So first things first, nuts and bolts, to answer the Congresswoman's question, how does it work?
I mean, it's just it's an embarrassing statement, I have to just say, by our policymakers who really know so little about technology that they're really in charge of making policy for. But what's happening in this case is kind of just good old fashioned Google washing or Google bombing. You know, this is a term that's been around for a long time. And it's where users or people who are technically skilled at search engine optimization are really able to associate keywords with certain people or images. Donald Trump isn't the first person to have this happen. Justin Bieber, George W. Bush. And this is something that is one dimension of how you can optimize an advertising platform, which is you can bring either money or technical skill to bear and have that help influence the kinds of things we see.
Some of the other lines of questioning were not far off Congresswoman Lofgren's inference there, or perhaps it's a supposition, that Google employees are manipulating individual searches. And as Pichai said, at scale, that's not really possible. But it's important to point out here that Google is not without bias.
Well, certainly there are human beings involved, as well as a host of factors that Google says go into its algorithmic decision making. We know, for example, that there are armies of what Sarah Roberts from UCLA has coined commercial content moderators. And these are people who really do have to be actively involved in scanning for things like child exploitation or other types of illegal material. So certainly people are involved, but I don't think it's at the inference that one person or a handful of people are just making decisions of a political nature.
You know, there was a question along the lines of should we have a Google school to teach people how Google works? Do you think that helps the national conversation at all, if that would come to pass?
No, I don't think that's the answer. I think the answer for a strong democracy and a highly literate public is to have multiple ways of knowing and multiple platforms and pathways to knowledge. Huh. What people really don't understand is that Google is an advertising platform. It's not a knowledge system. It's not the public library. It's not really an evidence-based information retrieval system. What we need is more public investment in public interest search that's free of kind of this commercial and technical manipulation that allows people to get good, reliable information rather than advertising or misinformation. And I think that's one of the things that we see more likely to happen in commercial search engines.
Sophia Noble teaches at USC Annenberg, just down the road from us. She's also written a whole bunch on algorithms and bias therein. Sophia, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
You bet. Thank you.
Here is a not entirely random question. When is water or a waterway not water? That question has a different answer today than it did yesterday after a new proposed interpretation of the landmark Clean Water Act by the Trump administration. Rivers and lakes? Yes, sure, they are water. But what about tributaries or bodies of water that dry up part of the year? The White House wants to narrow the scope of the Clean Water Act, exempting many of those tributaries and the intermittent waterways, as they're known. From the Sustainability Desk, Marketplace's Scott Tong has more on that.
Some of the loudest cheers came from property developers. They had been wary of building in watery areas where the rules were unclear. Randy Noel, a custom home builder in New Orleans, says there's a waterside slice of land there that was too iffy.
Everyone was afraid to buy that piece of land and do anything with it for fear they had to pay $35,000 for mitigation.
In other words, to fix it up and get a federal permit. Now, he says, the property is exempt, which could bring his partner back on board.
This definition, I'm going to go back to him and say, okay, look, let's go take another hard look at this piece.
Farmers also applauded today's news. Stephanie Smallhouse owns a farm and ranch in southern Arizona. She grows alfalfa and oats in a dry creek area, also a gray area under the law.
We were in jeopardy of essentially breaking the law, and we have to grow our crops. And so in the interim, we've just been continuing to do what we were doing before.
Now she feels at ease. Many environmental groups say half the country's wetlands are endangered by this change. They're defined as ephemeral streams and now fair game for developers. Colorado attorney Melinda Kasson is with the Theodore Roosevelt Conservation Partnership.
They could build housing that would cover up ephemeral streams, or you could plow under ephemeral streams on the plains. So you're going to lose potentially important habitat.
But this is just a proposed rollback. After it takes effect in a year or so, it's likely to get challenged in court. In Washington, I'm Scott Tong for Marketplace.
Another one of those seesaw days on Wall Street today. Up a whole bunch, then mostly down at the close. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, tariffs and trade. There has been a hint today, two hints, actually, that China is reconsidering its car tariffs, the import duties that it bumped up from 15 to 40% in response to President Trump's tariffs on Chinese imports over here. We got our China correspondent Jennifer Pack on the phone today from our Washington Bureau to help sort this stuff out. Hey.
Hey, Kai.
Bloomberg had this morning, as I said. Now this afternoon, a White House official has anonymously confirmed it, that the Chinese are going to cut their automobile tariffs from 40 to 15%. It sounds like a big deal. Jennifer, is it?
If you're Ford and GM, maybe not, because most of the cars that they sell, the Buicks, the Cadillacs, mm-hmm. those are made in China in a joint venture with the Chinese company. But in terms of consumer sentiment, maybe it does, because now it's signaling to Chinese consumers it's okay to buy American cars.
Just politically, right?
Yeah, exactly, because consumers are not following this tit-for-tat tariffs right. that closely. They really don't know which models are being made in China or made in the U.S., which ones will be subject to tariffs. They really don't know all of this. So broadly, it just signals to them that it's okay to buy American cars.
When you walk out the front door of your apartment in the morning to go to work at the bureau, I mean, what kind of cars are driving by?
Well, in the downtown area, there are lots of affluent people. So you do see sometimes Porsches. You see Buicks for sure. A lot of ride-sharing apps, they drive those. They're very popular. You know, at the Import Expo that recently mm-hmm. was held in mm-hmm. Shanghai, there are people crowding around the Cadillac display. You know, there's a gentleman next to me who was pulling his friends in and said, come see this car. This is the vehicle that chauffeurs the U.S. president around. And, you know, his friends were very impressed. They went in. They were touching all the leather inside. There's definitely a lot of appeal when it comes to certain American cars.
Right. All right. So now domestically, though, right, if they're importing all these cars, what about the Chinese domestic car market?
The domestic car market is facing an adjustment, if you will. In the last 5 months, sales have been going down. And people are worried because the government in previous years, they had a tax cut for smaller engine cars. And that helped, not because cars are that expensive, but every little bit helps because guess what? If you buy a car in China, you can't just drive it on the road the next day. In Shanghai and Beijing, you have to go and bid in a lottery or you have to go into an auction to get a license plate, which can sometimes cost more than the car itself. In the smaller cities, now you're running up against ride-sharing apps like Didi and Meituan, which are also very popular. So even though a lot of families have not had their first car yet, it's now less of a status symbol to own your first car. I remember 10 years ago in Beijing, if you saw a black Audi, that you knew was somebody important and quite possibly a government official. These days, people just don't want to be bothered with parking or anything like that. So, you know, it's sort of a change that the car makers are facing.
Our Shanghai correspondent, Jennifer Pack, in Washington today, actually making the rounds of our bureau. Jennifer, thanks.
Thanks for having me.
One quotes from corporate filings with the Securities and Exchange Commission at one's peril, but what you're about to hear is a $4.5 billion sentence. This is from a Verizon filing today, quote, Oath, that's the media company that Verizon created after buying AOL and Yahoo. Anyway, Oath has also achieved lower than expected benefits from the integration of the Yahoo and AOL businesses, end of quote. Translation, Verizon is going to write down the value of those purchases by more than $4.5 billion, about half the $9 billion it spent to buy them. Marketplace's Amy Scott reports on what went wrong with Verizon's plan to compete with the likes of Google and Facebook.
When Verizon bought AOL a few years ago and then Yahoo, there were a lot of skeptics, among them wireless industry analyst Jeff Kagan.
It just made no sense for a company that wants to be on the growing side of the growth curve to acquire companies that are on the falling side of the growth curve.
To me, it's an I told you so moment.
That's Michael Hodel, director of media and telecom research at Morningstar. The idea behind Oath was to create a mobile media giant that controlled not only the country's biggest wireless network, but more of the news, sports, and entertainment content distributed on that network. But Hodel says it hasn't panned out.
And as they've been sort of searching for a way to bring those two businesses together, they've continued to lose ground against the industry's heavyweights, Google and Facebook.
Not everyone thinks the plan was destined to fail. Porter Bibb with MediaTek Capital Partners says Verizon has a key asset, data on its gazillion wireless users that could be used to sell targeted advertising on AOL's and Yahoo's platforms. But when new CEO Hans Vestberg took over in August,
Verizon's new management did not provide access to the customers' wireless data, so that Yahoo and AOL were pretty much handicapped.
Vestberg is a telecom guy, Bibb says, and just didn't see the value in the media business. Analyst Jonathan Chaplin at New Street Research says Verizon's got enough going for it without Oath.
They've built the best wireless business on the planet. They've consistently had the strongest product in this market for about 15 years.
And with Verizon's focus on rolling out next-generation 5G wireless technology, it'll have its hands full. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Many of my colleagues became lobbyists, made millions and millions of dollars, quite frankly.
From lame ducks to big bucks. But first, let's do the numbers. Another up and down day on Wall Street, as I said. Gains at the start and then a firm ending on meh. Dow Industrial is down 53 points today, 0.2%, 24,370. The NASDAQ rose 11 points, about 0.1%, 7,031. The S&P 500 essentially unchanged, 26.36. We looked at the challenges for Verizon, Amy Scott did. This company announced that $4.6 billion write-off. Verizon up nearly 1% today. Comcast dialed down 1.3%. As we mentioned, Google CEO Sundar Pichai was on Capitol Hill today. Google parent Alphabet found 0.8%. Facebook clicked up about 0.1% today. Twitter posted up 3%. China and auto tariffs, we touched on briefly. Ford climbed 0.2%. General Motors pumped up more than 0.75%. You're listening to Marketplace. You make financial decisions every day, from minor transactions to major life choices. And that's why Marketplace covers the economy from so many different angles, connecting the dots between the micro and the macro. As a nonprofit organization, we depend on individuals like you to help us provide trustworthy news that adds value to your life. If you're not yet a Marketplace investor, please contribute today at marketplace.org, and your gift will be matched dollar for dollar. And thanks.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. As talk of the next recession becomes just a bit stronger, and let's be clear here, right? There is going to be a recession. It's just a question of when. Anyway, a whole lot of forecasts and predictions are being made, but the actual deciders on when a recession starts, and when it ends, actually, are the people who sit on something called the Business Cycle Dating Committee of the National Bureau of Economic Research. James Peterba is the president of the NBER. He's also a professor of economics at MIT. Welcome to the program.
Pleasure to be with you.
First things first, what is the National Bureau of Economic Research? Who are you guys?
Well, the NBER was founded in 1920 when there was much less information and data on the U.S. economy. The two founders, one of them was a Marxist labor organizer. The other was a corporate titan who worked for AT&T. They'd served on some commissions in the state of New York, and they disagreed on the policy recommendations most of the time, but they agreed that there was no data on the labor market or related issues. So they created this organization, and we are not allowed to make policy recommendations, but we disseminate economic research, analyze data, and we have the responsibility for trying to date the turning points in the U.S. economy as well.
Understood, and that's kind of a perfect setup. So without wanting anybody to read anything into the fact that you and I are having this conversation, when the Business Cycle Dating Committee at the National Bureau of Economic Research sits down and looks at things and starts thinking about the business cycle, what is it looking for? What's it looking at?
Well, if it's looking for a recession, it's looking for evidence of a significant and sustained downturn in economic activity that is broadly distributed across the economy. It's not looking for just a blip. It's looking for something that's more substantial. And it uses a number of different measures to try to gauge what's happening.
So let's put this one to bed. It's not that whole two cycles of negative GDP growth, two quarters, right?
It's not. And the reason we do not do that is because you could easily imagine a situation in which, you know, real GDP declines by 0.1% in one quarter, 0.1% in another quarter, while at the same time, employment is rising, real gross domestic income is rising, and it just doesn't look like a sustained downturn. And what the committee, while it admittedly is, you know, it's a group of 10 people, and it's looking at a variety of different measures, it's making ultimately a somewhat subjective call, but it's trying to use judgment to impose on the data rather than going with a very simple rule in these cases.
It's always retrospective, right? I mean, just for the Great Recession, which started in December of 2007, the Business Cycle Dating Committee didn't figure that out until I think it was like the summer of 2008 or something.
No, I remember this very well.
It
was the Monday after Thanksgiving when we announced that the U.S. economy had entered a recession in December of the previous year.
Yeah.
We got some, I wouldn't call it fan mail, we got some rather harsh commentary from the public for announcing that we were in a recession at that point.
I bet. The point to make here, though, is that by June of 2009, we were out. So it was long, it was deep, but in the grand scheme of things, it was only 18 months.
That's right. Now, do remember that, you know, when when we think about a recession, it's a time when economic activity is declining. But it does not mean that when we're out of a recession, economic activity is at the level that we would like to be. It's a little bit like saying, you know, you've descended the Grand Canyon, you're at the bottom, and you're just starting to climb back out. Oh, well, you're no longer going down, but you're still not back anywhere near the top.
Right. Okay, so with all the appropriate caveats in place that, you know, we're not calling anything right now and recession's not starting tomorrow, what are you as a practicing economist looking at right now?
Well, the Business Cycle Dating Committee looks only in retrospect. So the variables that it tends to focus on are, you know, real gross domestic product and real gross domestic income, employment numbers, and sometimes looks at retail sales, also industrial production. And of course, you know, it's important to remember that since we're looking at is the economy expanding or contracting, there's a lot of discussion today about, you know, numbers that are not growing as quickly as they were earlier in the year. Yeah. But that's a far cry from numbers that are declining.
Jim Peterba, he's the president of the National Bureau of Economic Research, also a professor of economics at MIT. Sir, thanks very much for your time. I appreciate it.
It's a pleasure to talk to you. Have a great day.
There are, plus or minus, about 100 members of Congress, House and Senate, leaving Capitol Hill come January, most of them Republicans, as it happens. Some of them are retiring, some of them lost, but either way they're going, they're part of the biggest congressional exodus since before World War II. Nowadays, what usually happens is that about half of the used-to-be lawmakers who decide they want to keep on working wind up going to K Street, shorthand for Washington's lobbying industry. And given the size of this year's exiting class, that job hunt is going to be pretty competitive. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer looks at the business of being a former member of Congress.
It's packing day in Congressman Rick Nolan's office.
They're like technically two different shipments.
Nolan's staffers are stuffing boxes with pictures and mementos. Nolan, a Democrat from Minnesota, has served two stints in Congress. The first one was from 1975 to 81. When he left that year, lobbying was just becoming a thing in Washington.
Many of my colleagues became lobbyists, made millions and millions of dollars, quite frankly.
Like who?
Oh, I don't want to mention any names.
Nolan did not become a lobbyist. He returned home to Minnesota, where his family owned a sawmill and he ran an export business. Nolan was reelected to the House in 2013. He says he's not going to become a lobbyist after this stint in Congress either, although he would consider consulting work for the lumber or mining industries.
If any one of those interests came to me and said, hey, we could use a little help here, would you testify? I'd say, sure.
Nolan's just one guy. But if he's not looking for a job on K Street, that's one less competitor for the crowd of departing lawmakers who are. Technically, job hunting isn't supposed to start until departing members of Congress have actually departed. But that doesn't stop them from unleashing their people on people like this guy.
My name is Rich Gold. And I am the head of the public policy group at Holland & Knight in Washington.
Holland & Knight is a global law firm with a significant lobbying operation, including four ex-members of Congress from both parties. That's actually a lot of former lawmakers by D.C. standards. Gold says Holland & Knight isn't in the market for any more, but he's still getting overtures like this.
Just wanted to catch up and, you know, think about what I'm going to be doing next. And, you know, was told you're a good person to talk to about these things.
Gold says that congressional inquiry came as a voicemail. Gold has also been buttonholed when he's out to dinner. Two exiting lawmakers sidled up to his table recently. They also just wanted to catch up.
Usually it's the other way around where I'm walking up to a dinner table and excusing myself and saying, hey, how are you doing? Would love to catch up on this issue.
Gold says for powerful committee chairs, who are all Republicans since the GOP still controls Congress, there will be no role reversal. They'll still call the shots.
The Ways and Means and Finance Committee, the tax writing committees, are very attractive.
Legally, congressional expats can't become registered lobbyists for a year if they were in the House and two for the Senate, but
they can act as senior advisors, strategic advisors, directing the lobbying troops from the rear.
That's Sheila Krumholtz, head of the Center for Responsive Politics. She says there's a reason nearly half of departing members from both parties who continue working become lobbyists.
Some of them are collecting seven-figure salaries. And there are also the bonuses if they are successful in their lobbying campaigns for clients.
And those exiting members who don't snag a lobbying gig, they have lots of other options. Think tanks, trade associations, and they know how to job hunt. After all, each one of them has convinced thousands and thousands of voters, sometimes year after year, that they're the only person for the job. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall Genzer for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, in which Scott Gottlieb, the commissioner of the Food and Drug Administration, gets points for creativity even as he kills one of life's small joys. Maybe you saw that advisory the other day from the Centers for Disease Control not to eat raw cookie dough lest you get E. coli, among other unpleasantness. Well, today on Twitter, Gottlieb backed up his CDC colleagues with a little bit of Dr. Seuss. You cannot eat it in a house, he said. You cannot eat it with a mouse. We do not like it here or there. We do not like it anywhere. We do not like raw chocolate chip cookie dough. We do not like it. Hashtag FDA we are. Okay. All right, we got to go. The Dow off 53 points today, about 0.2%. The NASDAQ up 11 points, a 10%. S&P 500 basically unchanged. Our digital team includes Sarah Menendez, Tony Wagner, and Joanne Griffith. Ben Hethcote is our digital visual producer. Sarah Muti is the executive director of digital. Sitar Nieves is our executive director of On Demand. I'm Kai Rizdal. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.